a sad and lonely figure. Shouten was given a grave in a place apart from the others. I thought this might be because of differing religions, but it appeared that they wished to make his resting place special, and it was clear that they mourned him deeply. I thought that he would have a better memorial than he might ever have realized would be his lot, and was glad of it. The islanders were already clearing away rubble, and most of the patients had vanished into other homes when we left that afternoon. There was nothing we could find to take with us as proof of the disaster. The hospital records and all Shouten's personal belongings had been destroyed. We took photographs, though, and I included a couple of the natives gathering round Campbell and Ian to shake their hands as proof of our friendship, and also of the crew at the mass funeral. As Ian conned Esmeralda out through the pass of Tanakaboo, he asked sadly, "What kind of men are there to do a thing like that? You told us they were dangerous. They seem demented, Mike." "They must be psychopaths," I said. "From what I learned from the Dutch doctor, Hadley certainly is." Shorty Powell came on deck, white-faced, at the same time that Campbell emerged, looking thunderous. "I got something to show you," he said, and took me down to Kane's cabin, together with Ian. On the bunk lay a brown painted gadget, which Shorty had clearly recognized and shown to Campbell. "It's a walkie-talkie, surplus American army stock, selling for about $15 each. The range on land isn't much over 5 miles, but on water you can keep contact for, say, about 10 miles, Shorty supplied. "So that's how Hadley's schooner turned up so opportunely. And that's what that damn transmission was that Shorty picked up. You said you thought it was a low-power job and very near. But who'd have thought it was from right here on Esmeralda?" Campbell nodded. "We've probably been shadowed all over the Pacific. Any boat could keep hull down on the horizon, and Hadley could have cozy chats with Kane." I picked up the radio and looked at it curiously. I don't think Kane was clever enough to think of this himself. This bears the hallmark of organization. "Ramirez," said Campbell, decisively. "Very likely," I said. I was trying to read any further implications into the find when Paula came looking for me, and Ian got back up on deck. "Jodie's asking for you," she said. She too looked tired, having spent all morning helping Claire on that dreadful beach, and I smiled and gave her a quick hug of friendship and support. "How is he?"
"He'll be all right, but he's going to need medical care in Papeete, maybe stitches. I'm not a trained nurse, you know."
Considering the dangers we had drawn her into and the shocking things she had seen, I thought she was holding up amazingly well. But then I think toughness was bred into her.
"He may be scarred for life," she added.
"A pistol whipping is a lousy thing. Damn Hadley," said Campbell. We found Geordie sitting up in his bunk, his eyes peering brightly at me through a mass of bandages. He'd been told about the fire and the smashed radio, but was avid for more. "How are you feeling?" I asked him.
"Not so bad, considering, but I haven't heard the whole story yet."
"What happened last night between you and the doctor?" he demanded, and I realized with a start that so much had happened since that I hadn't had time to pass on Shouten's terrible story. Having made sure that he was well enough to listen, I gathered Paula, Claire, and Campbell into the cabin. They heard me out in stunned silence.
"It's a bad thing," I said, heavily at the end.
"It is that," said Geordie. "They must be off their heads." I said, "I don't think Kane's the crazy one. It's Hadley who's the lunatic, a psycho for sure. Kane's cleverer than we thought him to be, though." I told Geordie about the walkie-talkie. Campbell said, "We've been played for suckers, and I don't like that one little bit. But with this act, I think they've outreached themselves. I have a feeling that Hadley ran amok, and even Ramirez isn't going to like it when he finds out."
I've been thinking, trying to put the jigsaw together, you might say, said Geordie. But some of the pieces don't seem to fit.
Such as?
For one thing, you say that according to Shouten, Kane and Hadley murdered Mark, and that Ramirez was in on it. Why do you think they killed Mark?
I said, I've been thinking about that.
It was something that poor old Shouten said, that Hadley had laughed when he asked to see the body and said it would turn the stomach even of a doctor.
What would that mean to you?
Knowing what we do of Hadley, it could mean torture.
And why should they torture Mark?
I should have felt ill at the very thought, but somehow it had all become rather academic to me.
Why does anyone torture anyone?
They wanted information out of him.
And Ramirez was there.
I think they wanted to know where the high cobalt nodules were to be found.
Yes, said Campbell.
I've already worked that out for myself.
Would Mark tell them?
I don't know. He'd look out for his own skin, but he was capable of being very scornful of people like them. He may not have realized that they really meant it until they got down to business, and then it might have been too late.
The girls studied me in silence, appalled at my implication. But Geordie put it into words.
You mean Hadley ran amok again and went too far, and he died before he could talk?
I think so.
They clearly don't know the location, or they wouldn't be tailing us this way. So they buried their mistake, terrorized the doctor and sent Hadley to get Mark's stuff, hoping for leads there. Hadley bungled it and let the gear slip out of his fingers, thanks to you, Paula, and so Ramirez went to England to get it back, using Kane as scout and contact man.
It all seems to fit, Geordie said.
He lay back on his bunk, suddenly looking exhausted. So we left him. We didn't talk about it among ourselves. We were all drained and saddened, and the trip back to Papeete was one devoid of much pleasure for any of us. We made a quick passage, and all went well, until we were within about 2 hours of Papeete, and longing to be ashore. I planned to take Ian, Campbell, and one or two members of the crew to the police as soon as we landed, leaving the others to guard the ship, especially Geordie and the girls, zealously. We had no idea where the Pearl might be, but I wanted to run no risks. I was in my cabin when word came down for me to get on deck fast. Ian, who was acting skipper, pointed to a boat on our starboard beam. It was a fast launch and was cruising around us in a wide circle.
"Yon lad is coming up awful fast, mate," he said to me. "He's up to something. It looks official."
He handed me binoculars, and I saw that it was a patrol boat, naval in style, even to a 4-pounder quick-firer mounted on the foredeck. It had a number, but no name, and as I looked, it turned to approach us directly.
"You'd better call Mr. Campbell," I said.
The launch came up alongside and kept pace with idling engines about 50 yards away. An officer by the wheelhouse raised a loudhailer, and a spate of French crossed the water. I raised my arms to shrug violently to indicate that I didn't understand. Another man took the loudhailer and shouted in English, "Heave to, Esmeralda, or we will fire." I looked at the gun on the foredeck. Two matelots were manning it. One had just slammed a magazine in, and the other was swinging the gun around to train it just about midships.
"What the hell?" I exploded. But one couldn't argue with a 4-pounder.
I heard Ian giving brisk orders, and the sails came tumbling down everywhere, as the off-watch crewmen tumbled up on deck, Campbell among them.
"What the hell's going on?" he asked loudly.
"We're being boarded by the Navy," I said, "in the traditional style. If we don't stop, they'll open fire. The man said so."
Campbell looked at the little gun in fascination.
"Well, I'll be double damned," he said. "Pirates? Not this close in, it's official."
The sails were all down,
and Esmeralda lost way and started to pitch a little. The patrol boat edged nearer and finally came alongside. Lines went across, and an officer jumped on board, followed by three sailors. He had a revolver, and the sailors were carrying submachine guns. Our men backed up, alarmed and disconcerted by all this, and I saw Campbell make a violent, if surreptitious, gesture to the girls to keep below decks.
"Monsieur Trevelyan," the officer barked.
I stepped forward. "I'm Michael Trevelyan." A submachine gun lifted until the muzzle was pointed at my stomach.
"You are under arrest."
I looked at him dumbfoundedly.
"What for?"
Campbell stepped forward aggressively.
"Now look here," he began.
The officer gestured and the other two sailors lifted their weapons, and there were ominous snicks as the safety catches were released. Ian caught at Campbell's shoulder and he subsided. The officer said,
"You will learn about it in Papeete. You will please come aboard my boat. You," he turned to Ian, "you will accompany us in under engine. These men will stay on board with you. You will attempt nothing foolish, please."
I looked into his cold grey eyes and realized that he wasn't kidding. I felt a sense of sick reluctance to leave the Esmeralda, but there really was no choice, and I swung myself across without a word. I was briefly searched and then led below to a cabin with a minimum of furnishing, a cell afloat. And once inside, I heard the door being locked. I was on my own. 4. I was pretty miserable. I didn't know what was going on, nor had I any means of finding out, though I certainly had ideas, too many of them. If only I could have talked to someone, I would have felt better, but that was impossible. I wondered how they were all making out. We went the remaining few miles into Papeete at a speed slow enough for Esmeralda to keep up, no doubt still under the threat of the gun. There were no portholes in my cabin, and I couldn't hear much either, but the arrival at a jetty was unmistakable, and I braced myself for whatever was coming. Sure enough, within a few minutes they were at the door, unlocking it, and then I was brought up into the sunshine, to see that we were back in Papeete, but not in our old position. Instead, it seemed to be a naval area. I saw Esmeralda tied up alongside us, but there were only French sailors on deck, none of my friends to be seen. A police car was waiting for me. My legs felt like lead as I went ashore and got into it. There was a police station, possibly the principal one, and I was taken immediately and without any formalities into another cell and left there. It was devastatingly bleak. A good couple of hours passed, and then I was let out once more, this time to be escorted to a large business-like office and to confront an angry-looking, mottle-faced man behind the inevitable desk. I stood in front of it with my escort and another man behind us at the door. I had already decided on a plan of action, such as it was. I was going to go immediately on to the offensive. To be meek was intolerable to me, and also foolish, for it might imply guilt where I certainly felt none. So as soon as the man in front of me began to speak, I overrode him. "I want to see the British consul."
"Sit down."
"No, I answer no questions without the presence of the consul." He slapped the table with the flat of his hand, and I was jerked back into a chair. I saw a nameplate on his desk, which told me that he was one Jacques Chamon, and with a title which I mentally translated as Chief of Police. I was right at the top, it seemed. It had to be pretty bad. And I already had a ghastly suspicion as to what it was.
"I stand on no ceremony with you, Trevelyan," another man with more than passable English. "There has been a massacre at Tanakabu, which you started, and we will have your head for it."
I stared at him, outraged.
"Are you crazy?"
He leaned his elbows on the desk.
"I have a dossier here on you. You came to Papeete last week and made some very serious accusations against Dr. Shafton on Tanakabu.
accusations which would ruin his reputation as a medical man. You were told that someone would take steps to verify your vilifications, but that was not good enough for you. You cleared Papeete with the stated intention of sailing westward, but instead you went to Tanakabur. I listened in silence, in spite of my resolve. You got to Tanakabur and evidently had a quarrel with Shouten, and you murdered him. To cover your tracks, you set fire to his house, and the entire hospital caught fire, resulting in many deaths. Your crew is implicated in this as well. You are all guilty men. I blinked and sank down in the chair, stunned by the rage in his voice and the whole messy situation. We had made a very fast return trip to Papeete, and as far as I knew, there were no radio telephones on Tanakabur, so there was only one way the police could know what had happened. I seized on a couple of things he said, and decided to make the best use of them that I could. "Can it be that you don't know exactly how many were killed? Have you had any direct contact with the island?" I asked rapidly. I didn't know how much time I would have before he had me silenced. He hesitated, and I knew I was on the right track. "How did you get the information? Was it a man called Hadley off a ship called the Pearl?" That went straight to the mark, a bullseye. He coughed, oddly hesitant, and said, "I do not see that it makes any difference, but you are correct. Mr. Hadley described the reign of terror on Tanakabur very circumstantially. He stated that he barely escaped with his own life, and that you attempted to run his ship down." Good. I had him on the defensive already. It was I who should be doing the talking, not he. I sensed already the faintest thread of doubt in his voice and pressed on. "You say I evidently quarrelled with Dr. Shouten. What evidence is there?" I left him after a long talk, none the worse for it. There was a witness to that, an islander called Pirro. He drove me from my ship. He will also attest that we came to save the hospital when it was already burning, and so will many others there. You have no right to arrest me or any of us. He was listening intently and did not interrupt me. Behind me, the policemen stood like statues. I didn't understand why things were going my way, but I was feeling stronger by the minute. "Why don't you study that file, Monsieur Chamon? You've got it down in black and white. Hadley was the man who was supposed to have found my brother, but whom I say was his murderer, and Shouten told me so. I can't prove that now, but I can prove everything else." I remembered another fact, and produced it triumphantly. "I took photographs, developed my film. It will tell you everything." "Monsieur Trevelyan, I am listening carefully. Of course we will check your camera, and we have already sent a police patrol boat to Tanakabur. But you still have a great deal to explain, and you are not yet released from arrest." I said, "Well, I've got plenty to tell you. That damn bastard and his mate Kane, they're the ones you want. They murdered Sven Norgard. They murdered my brother. They murdered that poor bloody Shouten. And they killed 14 patients in his hospital. Burnt them alive. Do you hear? They burnt those poor wretches alive." Chamon was gesturing to the two policemen, who heaved on my shoulders. I had lost all restraint in my anger and was trying to climb over the table in my frenzy of trying to make Chamon see the truth. I slumped back, shaking a little and fighting for self-control. There was silence for a moment as we all contemplated my words. "Where is Hadley now?" I asked him, trying to stay on the offensive. He regarded me closely in silence still, then nodded gravely. He gave instructions to one of the men in rapid French, and the officer left the room smartly. Then he looked at me. "I am not yet ready to believe you, but we will speak again with Monsieur Hadley, I assure you. Meantime, I ask you to explain this, if you can." He pointed to a small box on a side table, and one of the remaining policemen brought it to his desk. Opened, it revealed four guns and a little pile of boxes of ammunition, I recognized two of the guns immediately. Four guns with enough ammunition to start a war, Monsieur Trevelyan. Not a cargo for a peaceful ship, a scientific expedition. Where did you find them? But I could guess. And I was troubled. This was going to set back the progress I'd made. Three in the cabin of your Monsieur Campbell, one in the possession of Monsieur Wilkes, your captain. I made a weak gesture. There didn't seem to be much to say. You have seen them before? I said, yes, two of them. Mr. Campbell gave me that one when we discovered that Kane had gone from our ship. I must tell you the whole story, in sequence, you understand. This one, he had himself. But, neither of us fired a shot. If you exhume Shouten, you'll see he was shot three times, I think. Only the other two were fired. Yes, on our ship, when Hadley was getting away. We did try to ram him, to stop him, to bring him to justice. That phrase sounded melodramatic enough, even for a Frenchman to gag on it, I thought. You will tell me the story. So I did, leaving out all references to our search for manganese nodules, to Ramirez and Suarez Navarro. I thought that made it all far too complicated. I said only that Hadley, once chartering a boat for my brother and Norgard, had quarrelled with them for reasons unknown, had murdered both of them, and had implicated the Dutch doctor in his crime. I had come to seek the truth, and had run into a hornet's nest. It was circumstantial and very tidy. He made notes from time to time, but said little. When I finished, he said, "You will write all this down and sign it, please. I'm going to allow you to return to your ship, but you will see that you and all your crew are confined to quarters on board. There will be a police guard." He was interrupted by the return of the officer he had sent out, who came straight to his side and whispered agitatedly to him. They both got up to look out of the window and went on speaking in urgent undertones in French, and somehow I guessed what they were talking about. "It's Hadley, isn't it?" He turned to face me. "You've let him get away, haven't you? You've let that murderous thug walk out of here." He nodded heavily. "Yes, he has apparently left. You must understand that there was no reason to hold him. After he placed the information and made a deposition, we would not expect him to leave here. It is his home port." Something about the way he spoke told me that he was deeply troubled, to the point of forgetting that he was speaking to a man under arrest. I could guess why. Hadley was surely known here as a tough and troublemaker. The police may well have had him under surveillance already, for his connections with Mark and Norgard, and, for all I knew, for a score of other things. And, in letting him get away, Monsieur Chemin had blotted his own copybook rather badly. I was furious and exultant at the same time. He got himself in hand and gave instructions to take me back to Esmeralda, and I was only too happy to go. House arrest seemed insignificant compared to being locked up in a cell. I went on board and was not particularly bothered by the sight of armed police dotted about, a couple on deck and more on the quayside, and a little knot of spectators shifting about, as if waiting for a show to begin. In fact, I managed a grin and a half wave at them as I was ushered below, to their delight and the guard's disapproval. There was a babble of voices at my return, and the same air of tense expectancy as on the dockside, only here it was tinged with anxiety and bafflement. They all crowded around me and started firing questions. "Wait up." I held them off, good-naturedly. "Plenty of time. Too much of anything. First, I want a wash-up and about a gallon of coffee and some food. Who's cook?" I headed determinedly for my cabin to get a change of clothes, leaving the others to see to my inner comforts, and was brought up by the sight of Geordie, still in his bunk in the cabin we'd been sharing all along. "Geordie, what the hell are you doing here? Shouldn't you be in the hospital?" I was already seething at this inhuman treatment,
but he waved me down casually. "I'm fine, boy. It's good to see you. What happened to you?"
"Geordie, I'll tell you together with the rest once I've washed and had some coffee. Are you sure you're all right?" But in fact, he looked a lot better, and I could see that his face had been professionally attended to, with neat stitches and tidier bandaging. As I stripped, he said, "They wanted to cart me off, but I sat firm. There's nothing wrong with me that their pretty visiting nurse can't fix. I'd get her to take a look at you, too."
He nodded at my hands, still partly covered with burnt skin, though they had started to heal pretty well on the short trip back. I completed a quick ablution, and was finally seated in the saloon over breakfast, and surrounded by the whole of the crew of the Esmeralda, bar one. It was an immense relief not to see Kane's face among the others. I told them as much as they needed to know, reserving a few more private comments for Geordie and Campbell later.
"He's a worried man, that Chamon. It was even when he saw me, and he has to be even more so now that Hadley's skipped," Campbell said.
"He saw you?"
"Oh, yes. And the girls, too. And Ian. Wanted to speak to Geordie, but he was unaccountably sicker just then."
Geordie, propped up on a saloon berth, winked at me, and I realized that my news had cheered everyone up amazingly. Although we and our ship were all technically still under arrest, it was clear that we weren't in any real trouble, thanks to the various bits of evidence I had offered the police chief, and we lacked only physical freedom, not any of the oppression of spirit that imprisonment usually meant. "Tell me about your interview," I asked Campbell. It had apparently been somewhat hilarious. Instead of being chastened at being caught with a small armoury under his bunk, Campbell was airy and unconcerned about it, claiming that the guns were properly licensed, that he was a well-known collector, and wouldn't dream of travelling without something for target practice, and that, in any case, only one of his guns had been fired, and that by his daughter, gallantly defending herself from an attack by a shipload of murderous pirates. He was scathing about Claire's poor shooting, and seemed not at all troubled by her having winged a man, only irked by her not having killed him outright. It appears that while in Papeete, Kane had had a small bullet taken from his shoulder, ironically by the same doctor who tended to Geordie. He was not, it seemed, badly hurt, which disappointed Campbell considerably. He was soundly reproved for not having declared the guns on his arrival, and was threatened with their confiscation, but he wangled his way out of that somehow, and had got away with their being sealed at the mouth for the duration of our stay. It turned out that the other gun that I had seen belonged to Nick Duggan, and he was similarly ticked off. According to Claire, there had been at least two other small handguns in use during Esmeralda's fight with Pearl, but none of them surfaced during the search that was made, and I asked no questions. I also learned that Geordie had a shotgun on board, which, apart from being legally licensed, had even been declared by him to the Papeete Customs, and was the only gun on board that had not seen some action. Campbell had blustered much as I had, and had invoked all the powers he could think of to back his credentials, and apparently Monsieur Chamon had done much what he had done with me, had let him speak at will, listened carefully, and had finally released him back to the ship, with a fairly mild request that he write down an account of the affair. Everything pointed to our story being accepted, and indeed, later that afternoon, the guards began to let us all out on deck in twos and threes for some exercise, after they'd moved Esmeralda to a mooring buoy, well away from the quayside. Things were looking up, and we all turned in that night a great deal happier than we'd been at the start of the day. 5. A senior police official came on board next morning and took formal statements from everyone on board, which took a considerable time, though some of us had written them out in advance, and needed only to sign them in the official presence.
My camera was removed as well, and I prayed that my photography had been up to scratch. The doctor came to see Geordie again, and Campbell cornered him and asked innumerable questions about the hospital on Tanakabu and about the possibility of getting another doctor to go out there soon. We were all beginning to feel restless and uneasy. In spite of some relaxation, we were still confined to the ship, and as they kept us battened down, apart from whoever was being allowed on deck, it was stifling and airless on board. Sometime in the afternoon, Geordie sent word that he'd like a word with me, and so I went to his cabin. He was propped up in bed and surrounded by books. His face was still heavily bandaged, but he was obviously much stronger, and the effects of the concussion had long worn off. "Sit down, boy," he said. "I think I've found something." "To do with what?" I asked, though I could already guess. Several of the books were nautical, and the pilot was prominent among them. "Has it got to do with those damned nodules?" "Yes, it has. Just listen a while, will you?" I felt a small, indefinite itch starting in the back of my skull. At the end of the terrible business on Tanakabu, I had felt sickened of the whole search, and had wanted nothing more to do with it. The nodules could lie on the seabed forever, as far as I was concerned, and with the murder of Mark more or less exposed, even the urge to lay that ghost had died away to a dull resignation. But now, deprived of ordinary activity, I couldn't help feeling that it would be interesting to have the problem to chew on again, and my professional curiosity was rising to the surface once more. So I settled down to hear Geordie out without protest. "I was thinking of that lunatic, Cain," he said. "He slipped up when he mentioned New Britain, the time he shouldn't have known about it. I got to thinking that maybe he'd slipped up again, so I started to think of all the things he ever said that I knew of, and I found this. It's very interesting light reading." He handed me Volume 2 of The Pacific Ocean Pilot, opened at a particular page, and I began to read where he pointed. Before I had got to the bottom of the page, my eyebrows had lifted in surprise. It was a lengthy passage and took some time to absorb, and when I had finished, I said non-committally, "Very interesting, Geordie. But why?" He said carefully, "I don't want to start any more hairs. We blundered badly over Minerva, but I think that's the explanation of the other drawing in the diary. If it seems to fit in with your professional requirements, that is." It did. "Let's get the boss in on this," I said, and he half lifted himself from his bunk in delight. He'd played his fish and caught it. I got up and went to round up Campbell, Ian and Claire, and brought them back to the cabin. "Okay, Geordie, begin at the beginning." I could see that the others were as pleased as I had been to have something new to think about. "I was thinking about Cain," Geordie said. "I was going over in my mind everything he'd said. Then I remembered that when he'd seen Claire's drawings, he'd called one of them a scraggy falcon. We all saw it as an eagle, didn't we? So I checked on falcons in the pilot and found there really is a falcon island. The local name is Fonoa Fu'u, but it's sometimes called Falcon because it was discovered by HMS Falcon in 1865. Claire said, "But where's the disappearing trick?" "That's the joker," I said. "Falcon Island disappears." "Now wait a minute," said Campbell, a little alarmed. "We've had enough of this nonsense with Minerva." "It's not quite the same thing," said Geordie. "Recife de Minerva was a shoal, exact position unknown. Falcon, or Fonoa Fu'u, has had its position measured to an air, but it isn't always there." "What the hell do you mean by that?" Campbell exploded. Geordie grinned and said to me, "You'd better tell them. You're the expert." "Falcon Island is apparently the top of a submarine volcano of the cinder type," I said soberly. Every so often it erupts and pumps out a few billion tons of ash and cinders, enough to form a sizable island. I referred to the pilot. In 1889 it was over a mile square and about 150 feet high. In April 1894 there wasn't anything except a shoal. But by December of the same year it was 3 miles long, 1.5 miles wide, and 50 feet high. I pointed to the pages. There's a long record of its comings and goings, but to bring it up to date, in 1930, Falcon was 1.25 miles long and 470 feet high. In 1949, it had vanished, and there were 9 fathoms of water in the same position. I passed the book over to Campbell. What seems to happen is that the island gets washed away. The material coming out of the volcano would be pretty friable, and a lot of it would be soluble in water. He said, "Does this tie in with your theory of nodule formation?" It ties in perfectly. If these eruptions have been happening once every, say, 20 years, for the last 100,000 years, there's a hell of a lot of material being pumped into the sea. The percentage of metals would be minute, but that doesn't matter. The process of nodule formation takes care of that. What metals there are would be scavenged and concentrated, ready to be picked up. Campbell looked baffled. "You come up with the damnedest things," he complained. "First a reef that might or might not be there, and now a goddamn disappearing island. What's the present state of this freak?" I looked at Geordie. "I don't know. I'll check up in the pilot supplements, but they're often printed a little behind the times anyway. The locals may know. Where is Falcon or Fanua Watsit when it's available?" "In the Friendly Islands," I said. Claire smiled at that. "The Tongan group. It's about 40 miles north of Tongatapu, the main island." He frowned. "That's a long way from Rabaul, and that's where the Suarez Navarro crowd is, and it's a long way from here, where Mark was." I said mildly, "It's halfway between." He nodded thoughtfully, and we all chewed on it for a few minutes. After a while, I spoke up. "In the light of this information, I think it would be worth concentrating on Falcon, if you're carrying on, that is." I looked inquiringly at Campbell. "Yes, of course I am," he said energetically. His optimistic side was gaining steadily. "You really think this will be worth trying?" Claire supported me. I was sure those drawings meant something. "Minerva meant 2 months of wasted time," Campbell said. "What do you think, Geordie?" Geordie looked at me, but with conviction. "He's the expert." Ian Lewis waited with courteous patience. He was prepared to go anywhere and do anything that was wanted of him. In spite of the horror of Tanakaboo, he was having a wonderful time, away from the dullness of home life. The issue was settled for us while Campbell ruminated. A vagrant breeze from the open port flipped back a page or so of the pilot, and I happened to glance down. I looked at the page incredulously and began to laugh uncontrollably. Campbell said, "For God's sake, what's so funny?" I dumped the book into Geordie's hands, and he, too, began laughing. I said, "It seems we looked at the wrong Minerva. Look, Minerva Reefs, 260 miles southwest of Tongatapu. That puts them only about 300 miles from Falcon Island." "You mean there's another Minerva?" "That's exactly what I mean." Geordie handed him the book. "They're fully mapped. They're on a plateau 28 miles long. It's hard ground, shell, coral and volcanic cinders at a depth of 800 to 3,600 feet. Just like the Falcon Island, but much, much older and well-established," I put in. "Well, there's no mention of nodules," Campbell said. "Well, these are naval records, and the Navy wouldn't dredge for them. They just take soundings using a waxed weight to sample the bottom material. A nodule, even a small one, would be too heavy to stick to the wax." There was a rising air of jubilation in the small cabin. Campbell said, "Well, that does it, I suppose. We go to Tonga." He looked at us all fiercely. But this time, there'd better be no mistakes. So it was settled, what we'd do after we left Papeete. If we left Papeete. 6. It seemed a long time. Apparently, a patrol boat had gone to Tanakabu and returned 3 days later, during which time things had got a little easier for us, but not much. All the crew members had been allowed to go ashore, in batches, but Ian, the Campbells, and I were still confined, as was Geordie for slightly different reasons. Paula managed to be allowed ashore, mainly because she seemed to know everyone, including the policeman, but she only went under Jim or Taffy's escort, and didn't stay ashore for long, having little faith in Hadley's having truly disappeared. On the fourth day, we were taken ashore, Campbell and I, and driven to the police station, where we were ushered into the same office as before. Monsieur Chamon was awaiting us. He was quite pleasant. "Our findings on Tanakabu are consistent with your statements. I note that Monsieur Trevelyan called off the search as soon as he found that the man Kane was armed, which is a point in your favour. I also found that you saved many lives at the hospital, and it is known that you were all aboard your ship when the doctor was shot and the fire started. Also, your photographs were helpful." It was good news, and as near to an apology as we'd ever get. "When can we leave?" asked Campbell. Chamon shrugged. "We cannot hold you. If we had Kane and Hadley here, you would be expected to stay and give evidence at their hearing. But you haven't found them," I said bitterly. "If they are in French Oceania, we will find them. But the Pacific is large." At least they seemed convinced of Hadley and Kane's guilt, which would have come out sooner or later anyway. Hadley had been seen ashore, and recognised by several of the people on Tanakabu, and it made me wonder all the more why they had stopped in Papeete to put the police on a false trail, instead of picking up their heels. But I thought that perhaps Hadley, whose mental processes were not as evident as his brutality, really thought that we would be found guilty of his crime, and so out of his way forever. It was impossible to try and read his mind. Now, if they were being hunted by the law themselves, they would have less time to go after us, and we had already agreed to act as if they didn't exist. Otherwise, we'd get nowhere. "You can go whenever you want, Monsieur Campbell." "We're going west, as we originally said," Campbell told him. "We're heading towards Tonga. If we see them out there, we'll let the authorities know." We were being cooperative now, wanting no further opposition to our going about our own business. Chamon said, "Very well, gentlemen. You may go. I will send instructions for the police guard to be withdrawn, but you will take care to be on your best behaviour for the remainder of your stay here, and I also strongly suggest that you leave these waters soon. Your family," he pointed to me, "your family seems to cause trouble here, whether or not you intend to, and we do not want trouble on our hands." Campbell closed a hand firmly over my wrist. "Thank you, Mr. Chamon. We appreciate all you have said, and now you can arrange transport back to our ship, please." He was reluctant on general principles, but finally we got a ride back to the docks and a short run out to Esmeralda to carry back the welcome news of our release. Everyone deserved a couple of days off, and neither Campbell nor I begrudged them the time. The radio had been repaired, and we had a lot of planning to do before we could set sail for the Friendly Islands, one of which might be there or might not. 6. It was good to be at sea again, pounding along under the unfailing impulse of the trade winds. It would take about 6 days to sail to Tonga, and we soon settled into shipboard routine.
Geordie was up and about, although his face looked like the map of a battlefield. He was fit enough otherwise, and took over the command from a reluctant Ian, who had gloried in his brief spell as skipper. The fresh wind blew away the last taint of Tanakaboo, and everyone benefited, and Kane's disappearance had lifted the last reserve of secretiveness. They were all in the know now, including Geordie's own crewmen, as we felt that it was only fair to warn them all of possible danger ahead, though none had taken advantage of Geordie's offer to pay their fares home if they wished to leave us. And Paula was still with us. Somehow that had been taken for granted, and she had fitted in so well to shipboard life that there was no sense of surprise in her having agreed to come along. She and Claire set one another off nicely. I immersed myself in textbooks and charts. I wanted to study currents, so I asked Geordie for pilot charts of the area. "Not that there'll be any great help," I said. "The currents might have changed considerably in the last 50,000 years, and that's why Mark worked with Norgard. He was an expert at that sort of thing." "The pilot charts only have the surface currents," said Geordie. "Who knows what goes on under the surface?" "There are gadgets that can tell that sort of thing, though. I haven't one with me. And they can't tell us what went on 50,000 years ago, more's the pity," I expounded. "Here is Fanoa Fa'u. There's a warm offshoot of the south equatorial current sweeping southwest past the island. Well, that should mean that any nodule deposits will also be laid down southwest of the island. But it's a surface current. There may be other currents lower down, going in different directions. That we'll have to check if we can." I frowned at my own words. "The thing is, have those currents changed direction in those last 50,000 years? I don't know. But I shouldn't think so. It's not very long." Geordie snorted. I put my finger on the chart. "What I'm really worried about is this spot here. That's the Tonga Trench. Our dredge will only go to 30,000 feet, and horizon depth in the trench is nearly 35,000. "Quite a bit of water," said Geordie, dryly. "That's over 6.5 miles. A man could drown in that depth of water. If the high cobalt nodules are formed at the bottom of the trench, we're wasting time," I said, ignoring his baiting. "You could dredge them up, but it wouldn't be an economic proposition. It would just amount to pouring money into the sea. By the way, I haven't mentioned this to the boss. It would only cause alarm and despondency, and it might never happen." "I won't tell him," he promised. But I did seek out Campbell for another reason, and found him on deck in his favourite spot, reading a book. We chatted for a few minutes about the ship and the weather, and then I said, "Is it true what Claire said, that you're a crack shot?" "I'm not too bad," he said, modestly, if a little complacently. "I'd like to learn how to shoot. I didn't get off a shot back there at Tanakaboo, and those bastards were popping off all over the show." He grinned. "What happened?" "I think I forgot to release the safety catch. I thought that might be it," he said. "It's obvious you don't know much about the game." "I don't know anything," I said, positively. "Good. Then you won't have any bad habits to get rid of. Stick around. I'll get the pistols." He came back with 4 guns and laid them on deck. 3 I'd seen, and 1, which was new to me, but a twin of the one I'd handled. I didn't ask him where it had been hidden. He said I didn't know what kind of trouble we'd be running into, so I took out insurance and brought along these 2.38s for you and Geordie. "What about yours?" "Oh, I like this, the .22. They're for me and Claire. She's a pretty good shot, if in need of practice." "I've always thought that a .22 was useless against a man," I said. "You're like the cops. They always think you can't use anything but a .38 or bigger," said Campbell, contemptuously. "Look at it this way. Who are the men who habitually use handguns?" I thought about it. "The police, the army, criminals, and hobbyists like yourself." "Right.
Now, an army officer doesn't get much time for practice, nor the wartime officer, so they give him the biggest gun he can hold, one that packs a hell of a wallop, a .45. With that gun, he doesn't have to be a dead shot. If he only wings his man, that man is knocked flat on his back. Campbell picked up a .38. Now, the police get more practice, and they're usually issued with or equip themselves with these. A nice, handy gun that will fit inconspicuously into a holster out of sight. But because of that, the barrel's too short, resulting in some loss of accuracy. You gotta have a lot of practice to be good with one of these. He exchanged it for a .22. With this, you have definitely gotta be a good shot. The bullet is small and hasn't any inherent stopping power, so you have to be able to put it in the right place. But the gun is deadly accurate. Well, this one is at any rate. If you meet up with a man who habitually packs a .22, steer clear of him, especially if he's filed away the front sight, because that means he's a snapshooter, a natural shot. I said, "What's the range of these guns?" "Oh, they've all got a hell of a range, but that's not the point. What counts is the accurate range, and with any handgun, it's not very much. A guy who is an average shot will stop a man at 10 yards with a .38. A crack shot will stop his man at 20 yards. And I'm not talking about target practice on the range. I'm talking about action, where the other guy is shooting back." He waved the long-barreled .22. "With this gun, I'll kill a man at 30 yards, maybe a bit further." I asked curiously, "You once said you had killed. Was it with this?" "Yes, in South America once. The jungle Indians don't like trespassers." He said no more about it, and I let it lie. So he began to teach me how to shoot. He started with the basic principles, stripping the guns and explaining the action. Then he showed me how to stand, and eventually how to hold a gun. "I'm not going to waste time with you on the classic stance," he said. "That's for the police and championship target boys. If you tried, you'd be filled full of holes before you sighted on your man. I want you to start with snap shooting. It's something you have or you haven't. Let's see if you've got it. Point your finger at the mast." I did so, and he followed the line of direction. "Not bad. If your finger had been a gun barrel, a steady one, you'd have made a hole in the mast just a little off-center. Do it again." So I did it again, and again, and again, and then he gave me a .38. "Now do it." I pointed the gun at the mast, and he shook his head. "You missed by a foot. Put your forefinger alongside the barrel, and do it again." I pointed the gun again, with better results. "You won't have your finger there when you shoot," he said. "It might be cut off by the action. But I want you to be able to point that barrel just like you point your finger." He drilled me for 4 hours every day on the voyage to Tonga. The rest of the crew crowded around at first, all asking for lessons, but Campbell declined, saying that one pupil at a time was his limit, and that, in any case, there were no spare guns. Geordie endorsed this. Those of the crew who did have guns did a little target practice, but no one had much ammunition to spare, and soon they left us to get on with it. I had to learn how to point the gun when standing, sitting, lying down, and lastly, after a sudden turn. Then he concentrated on the trigger finger, making me squeeze the trigger gently without a jerk. He filed the sear of the trigger until it clicked at a very slight pressure, and then made me practice a draw, snapping off the safety catch, pointing the gun, and squeezing the trigger all in one flowing motion. On the third day, I fired my first shot. Campbell set up a rough target in the bows, and when I stood near the foremast and squeezed that trigger, I was certain that I had missed. But he led me to the target and pointed to a hole only 2 inches off center. "You'd make a pretty fair 10-yard man," he said. "Give me another year or two, and I'll make a good shot out of you."
He took his .22 and, standing at the same distance, loosened off 6 shots in as many seconds. "Now look at the target," he said. He had put a neat circle of small holes round the larger one made by my bullet. "Give me time, and you'll be able to do that," he said, in reply to my honest praise. "I doubt if we'll have time, not if I run up against Kane and company in the near future." "You think we will? Suarez Navarro's ship is still up in Rabaul, as far as I know." "I don't think it will stay there," I said. "They'll be on our trail." Campbell suddenly seemed depressed. "How do we know it's the right trail? We're only going on a wild hunch, a hunch that a couple of doodle drawings do mean something." He turned and went below, the pistols dangling heavily in his hands. 2. We raised the island of Tongatapu on the morning of the 6th day out of Papeete. Nuku'alofa, the southern port of entry for the Tongan group, is on the north side of the island, so Geordie changed the heading of Esmeralda. He said to me, "There's a paragraph in the pilot that says you have to keep a sharp lookout for undersea volcanic activity and new shoals in these waters." I smiled. "Well, it sounds good from my point of view." "Yeah, not so good from mine. I have to skipper this ship." But we entered the anchorage without sighting anything unusual, tied up, and settled down to wait for the port officials. Nuku'alofa was a typical Pacific island town, the wooden houses with their galvanized iron roofs forever frozen in a late Victorian matrix. At one time, it had looked as though Nuku'alofa was going to be the chief trading port and coaling station of the Western Pacific, but Suva, in the Fiji Islands, eventually came out on top, possibly for no more profound reason than that it was an easier name to pronounce. At any rate, Nuku'alofa lost its chance and relapsed into a timeless trance. Once free to go ashore, Campbell headed for the post office as usual. I went off with the 2 girls who were going to book in at a hotel. Claire announced that she was tired of saltwater showers. "My hair's in a mess and I can't get the salt out. It needs cutting," she said. "I want fresh water and luxury for a while." I said thoughtfully, "It looks as though we may be based on Nuku'alofa for some time. Maybe I'd better do the same. Get a room for me and see if Geordie wants one. The ship's all right if you can get off it once in a while." Paula felt happier here too, with Hadley a remote risk and nobody else around whom she knew either. It was a lot more relaxing for all of us than our second visit to Papeete. We arrived at the hotel, and Claire said, "My God, look at all that gingerbread." It was a museum piece, sprouting galvanized iron turrets and cupolas in the most unlikely places. Inside, it was pleasantly cool and dark, with big electronic fans lazily circulating the air. At the reception desk, we ran into trouble when we asked for 5 rooms. They had only 3, 1 single and 2 doubles. I said to Claire, "Well, that's all right if you don't mind doubling up with Paula again. Geordie and I will share, and your father can have the single." The receptionist was most apologetic. There had been an unprecedented rush on accommodation just recently. I left the desk feeling that perhaps Nuku'alofa was going to give Suva a run for its money after all. We arranged with the girls to meet them in the lounge in an hour or so, and went upstairs to soak in a hot bath and to lay schemes for getting Claire away by myself somewhere that evening, the first chance I would have had since Papeete. When I came downstairs, I found them already in the lounge, with tall glasses of beer in front of them, frosted on the sides. "That's a good idea," I said, and looked at the label on the bottle. It was Australian beer, Swan. For a moment, I was back in London, on a wet, dull day, 1 million years ago. "That's Kane's favourite tipple. Maybe he'll be around for a drink." Claire looked past me.
Here comes Pop.
Campbell came over to the table with a sheaf of correspondence in his hand and the inevitable worried look on his face. Claire said, "Have a cold beer, Pop. It's just the thing for this weather." He dropped heavily into a cane chair, which creaked protestingly.
"I think we've come to the wrong place," he said abruptly.
I signaled to a hovering